Start again. Anyone? Okay. This whole thing of time is the life of contemplation is looking at how life is, and we sometimes fail to notice the ordinary. Quite often our meditations can be attempt to get the extraordinary, partially from things we've read, partially maybe we've had meditative experiences, and maybe the seeking of some very high state, which, as most of you know, can be very frustrating. But the ability just to contemplate the ordinary is very, very rewarding. It's really where insight arises. So to see, say, samadhi practice as a calming and brightening of the mind rather than just the seeking of high experiences. Otherwise, we might have just, like I said earlier, just take drugs. You know, why go through all this work? So it's not kind of getting high, or even like refinement. That can be a great monastic addiction, meditative addiction. Refinement, you know, and you get very, very beautiful states of mind sometimes in meditation. And then the coarseness of a traffic jam or argumentative people at work is very, very difficult to handle, very abrasive. Difficult enough as it is, but attached to refinement it becomes impossible. So it's non-grasping. This is the secret, non-grasping. So if one more and more learns to be the knowing, as we say, and contemplate ordinariness, that's really where we see where our grasping takes place, where the problems are, just in the ordinariness of life. And that's why I think most of Ajahn Sumedho's disciples and Ajahn Chah's disciples don't seem to be much into techniques. Kind of little sneaky little methods that get you enlightened. Little formula, and we'd all like that. Some really neat kind of formula that gets you enlightened. But I don't think it's that easy. And so say like time is an ordinary thing, and to actually contemplate it at the dharmic level. So again, if you remember considering a lot this idea of a social level of being. And a dharmic level of contemplation. So at the social level, there is Friday night, moving towards the end of the retreat. There is the future of responsibilities, family, relationships, job, travel. There's a sense of geography out there. We're here, London's over there, Canada's over there. There's the past, there's the kind of retreat you've had, the experiences, the memories, the insights, the lack of insight, the food, the person that was snoring next to you, and the different memories. But so that's at the social level, so you have like past and future. But the curious thing is, of course, that you can only know it now. And that's the dharmic level. That the future, like Ajahn Sumedho would always talk, the future is unknown. The past is a memory, now is the knowing. And that poem he likes to quote from T.S. Eliot. How does it go? Man's curiosity searches past and future and clings to that dimension. But to apprehend the intersection of the timeless with time is the occupation of a saint. No occupation either, but a life's death in love, ardor, selflessness, and self-surrender. And that idea of the intersection of the timeless with time is where Dharma meets the social reality, and that's the practice. That's what we mean by the practice, the practice of Dhamma. This is what we mean by that. Then time we consider not as kind of a chronological set of events and a file of facts that we are enslaved to, monastics included, but rather as a present event, as a present feeling, as a present perception. And that's very, you know, it's not any big deal, but that very kind of contemplation is what liberates us from time, from the sense of me being a person born in time and going to die in time. One of the perceptions which I really try to refuse to believe is that I was born and will die. You know, that I'm, conventionally speaking, there's a kind of a Germano-Latvian-Canadian-Thai-English Kiwi, sort of different places that my body's been thrown around, and there's the Latvian parents, and there's a sort of 1947 on the passport, and someone predicted I'd die when I was going to be 40. Two palmists said that, so that didn't work. But I, you know, as Dhamma, there's something in me which refuses to believe that that's who I essentially am, a 47-year-old body running through time, chronological time. Because that can be known, that very perception that I am Latvian, I am 47 years old, I am a man, and all the rest of it can be known. And what is it that knows that? And it's that knowing is the intersection of the timeless with time, the still point of being, different ways we talk about that. But then time, say, like, you know, you keep watching, like on a retreat, how the sense of time is dependently originated. It depends on your experience. So again, where you're going to, what your family is like, what the complexity of the situation you're going to, the amount of love or confusion in your family is going to condition the future. So if Amaravati is a kind of place of peace and refuge for you and a place of caring and so on, and then you're going to something maybe very chaotic and confusing, then there'll be anticipation of the future maybe. Oh God, you know, how am I going to face that? And it's true, one still has to face it, one can't get out of that. But that very sense of anticipation can be known in the moment, can't it? And then vice versa, if you know, you've had a really difficult time and, you know, nothing's clicked and you've had a lot of bodily pain and maybe your stomach was upset and you were falling asleep and then you'd wake up every now and then and, you know, just was very negative. And then you're going to a very loving and caring situation and you have a very creative vocation that you really, really enjoy, then there's the kind of a joyous expectation of something in the future. Fair enough, that contrast, fair enough. But that can be known in the moment. And knowing that as a condition of mind is knowing Dhamma. But attaching to that anticipation or that expectation with thought and continually creating oneself as this person who's going here and going there is what we mean by personality view, or getting reborn. This is of course different than planning. Planning is a skill, is a natural use of intellect, and so we do have to put in appointments in our diaries and plan our lives, and that's again at the social level. But the freedom of knowing anticipation is anticipation and not attaching to it is the freedom from time. The freedom, like in memory, say, how memory works, past. If you have some, I get memories from high school sometimes popping into my mind. And some memories from adolescence, it's not so nice. And that's just memory. But it has a sense of past in it. Then if there's attachment to that, of course, there's the creation of me as a being back then. So then if it's positive, it's nostalgia. If it's negative, it may be resentment or remorse and guilt. And the sense of self is again created in time. I was then and I did that at that time. And so the kind of mind swings from the between the past and the future. Man's curiosity searches past and future and clings to that dimension. But the intersection of the timeless with time is this knowing. Here and now, this is the way it is now. And the more we do that, then there is this sense of, there's still the movement of time, and there's still the ups and downs of life, but there begins to be a stability of the heart, which isn't leaving that anymore. And we begin to intuit what we mean, the sense of deathlessness, or not being born and not dying, more and more, by contemplating just those very ordinary feelings. Right. And that's the beauty of it, that like, say, on a retreat, whatever the quality of your experience is, you can begin to see how that conditions your ideas, your perceptions. It was a great retreat, it was a bad retreat, that can be known now. I'll never do another retreat the rest of my life. I'm going to do one tomorrow. I'm going to shave my head next week, or I'm going to become a born-again Christian. Whatever. I mean, it's just conditioned, isn't it? Just conditioned by things, and that can be known. And we don't have to, you know, we don't have to dismiss it all. You know, it can have relevance, but to no longer just be victimized by it, to begin to find that which is free from time at a Dharma level. The body is always subject to time. One's responsibilities, one's definition as a person in family, that will always be bound by time. So time is one of the parameters that we, that conventional reality functions in, this mind, these bodies live in. But the liberation from time is that ineffable sense of knowing Dhamma now. So, conventionally speaking, Friday night, so there's like a couple of days left, one or this Saturday, let's study Friday, right? Saturday and half a day Sunday. So, thinking of various things come to mind, various questions people have posed. Just if we consider the fourth part of the teaching on the Four Noble Truths, the Noble Eightfold Path. The way that's enunciated is right understanding and right thought. So beginning to see maybe how we can use that, not just as a formula, a Buddhist formula, but as actually tools for liberation. Right understanding, seeing things according to Dhamma. So in other words, like if I'm feeling anticipation now of some difficult event which is going to, you know, going to face me in a week and a half, then to know that as Dhamma is to know it as a feeling right now, and to realize that this is something that has arisen from causes and will stay for a while and it will cease. It's not a personal thing, I don't own it, it's just an event because of causes, and to grasp it will get me into trouble in some way. To begin to see anticipation as Dhamma. This is beginning to understand rightly anticipation as a Dhamma, right understanding, to see it as a, as we say, a sankhara that arises and ceases according to causes, to see. And then from right understanding you have the use of thought, you know, and this is very important, isn't it? How can I use thought in a right way to free me rather than the tendency, we get so enslaved by thought, don't we? We get victimized by thought. So I like to see thought as right suggestion, right attitude, perhaps a concentration, determination to focus your mind on an object, investigation of Dhamma. What does this feel like now? Rather than I shouldn't feel this way. So right thought, very important. So in other words, learning to listen to thoughts and seeing wrong thought, the obsession with thought, the thoughts of infatuation, or the thoughts of aversion, or the thoughts of conceit, you know, all of that, to begin to listen to that and see it as a sankhara, as a condition. Ajahn Chah used to say that anyone who's not yet arahat, fully enlightened, is mad. So he said, we're all practicing in a hospital, psychiatric hospital, the monastery. You can see what madness is, because when we take things personally, we're mad. In small ways or great ways. You can see, when I really believe that I am no good, you know, I really make a serious investment about self-hatred, I'm a bit crazy, aren't I? But when I see that, that's just a thought, and no longer believe it, then that's sanity. So we have a way of talking about what we call sanya vipala. We were talking about this at tea time, or the sangha, sanya vipalasa, ditta vipalasa, and jitta vipalasa. We're looking up this up in the Pali dictionary. Vipalasa is a perversion, a distortion, an inversion, a wrongness of view, of perception, of mind, and the way that sometimes described in the teaching is that when we see in the permanent, we see, when in the impermanent, we see permanence. And where in that which is unsatisfactory, we see satisfactoriness. And that which is, has no independent abiding nature, we see a soul or a self. Then that way of seeing is called vipalasa, sanya vipalasa. And when we believe that as a view, it's ditti vipalasa. It's a kind of a craziness. And maybe, you know, maybe we don't get put away for that, but we suffer for it. And that suffering is a part of our madness. So you can see how when I, let's say, if someone asked me to kind of talk a bit about infatuation, and that's a powerful kind of energy that we see human beings experience. Just as anger and fear, so also infatuation. And we can analyze it to death if we want, but it certainly grabs us. And I think all of us, the first time that happened to us, I like that English word, you're besotted with someone. Very good. You're totally infatuated. You can't get them out of your mind. You just kind of, everywhere you go, you know, you're thinking of that person. And then when you're with the person, there's the kind of exhilaration. But when you're away from them, there's the incredible longing, and the anticipation, and the hope, and you kind of, you know, it just kind of obsesses the mind all the time. And so people fall in love, and have relationships, and get married, and so on and so forth. And that's fine, but to see infatuation as permanent would be crazy. And I think the first time that happens for us, most of us are pretty crazy. Because we really think this is it. It's permanent. And I suppose most of us have seen the decline of that, where that infatuation, it can't last. And the disappointment of that, or we lose that in some way, and the grief of that, or the anger of that, or just the boredom, what changes. To say, and then to see like that infatuation as something which is satisfactory, and that's a pretty hard one, because it certainly is a very high, one of the highest kind of feelings you can get, isn't it? Yeah? So when we mean it's unsatisfactory, we mean it's not the deathless. We don't mean it's that infatuation is depression. It's not. It's a different kind of energy, isn't it? Infatuation. When one has kind of head over heels in love with someone. And of course, where it gets difficult is when we already have a commitment. it gets difficult otherwise too, but when we already have a commitment, then it's a very difficult energy to handle. So whether one is a monastic and one has vows to a certain way of life, one has fidelity to that, or one is in a marriage and one is faithful to that, when that infatuation then arises and it certainly threatens the monastic life or the marriage, it's an energy which needs to be understood. And what is needed with infatuation is renunciation. And renunciation isn't a denial of that, it's taking some kind of higher purpose, taking something more or greater than that, I suppose. And so for in a monastic life, the reason for taking the robe is the realization of Nibbana. And infatuation then is if it's seen as Dhamma, it's seen as anicca dukkha anatta. It's impermanent, it's not the deathless, and it's not something I own, so I can't keep it. It will change. It's dependent on causes. When it's not seen in that way, that infatuation, then what happens, of course, one begins to interpret the whole world through that. And even if one sees it that way, one still interprets the world that way. So we have feelings of jealousy, feelings of longing. We read everything in the other person that way. All the, you know, just a slight smile from the person, and we think they're totally in love with us. And then we find out they're not, and we feel disappointed. then we see them, and we see them across the field, and we know their image, and we see their sandals. And we say, oh, she's here. And the mind is just it's a very very powerful energy. And to give that one up, why would you give that up? Because you have family, or you get kids, or you have a friend who, you know, you honor more than that infatuation. And there's a kind of nobility in giving that up. So in monastic life, it's the inclination to Nibbana. And I don't know about lay life, I suspect it takes place every now and then in lay life, but in monastic life, certainly it's one of the most difficult to give up, because it's one of the most powerful, or the powerful energies that we have as human beings. And it's more than just sexuality, isn't it? It's more than just that. It's a yearning for intimacy, a yearning for friendship, and all kinds of ways. So if one has to work with that in some way, and one chooses the path of renunciation, then it's a matter, I think it's just a matter of wearing it out. And then the skill of the meditator is to as it comes up, of course, the mind tries to look for the object of infatuation, either through thought or visually. So it's a kind of seeking mind to be with the beloved in that way. And to give that up, it's a kind of a dying. There's a kind of a grieving there. And if one has a higher purpose, then one begins to be able to abide with the infatuation and no longer add to it with thought, with fantasy, with vision, looking, staring, those kinds of things. And through that kind of renunciation, then that energy will cease. And in the ceasing, there's peace. And there's a very lovely way of relating to men and women from that. It's not a fearful or a grasping way, or a way where one it forth as a spiritual friendship, and then working things through. And then, of course, then in that, one stuff begins to come up. Just like in monasticism, you come into the monastery, you feel inspired, but then you start to work with your karma. And you feel bored with it, and you feel restless, you feel bullshy. Then you get blissed out. You think, oh, I finally got it. And then you get disappointed because you've lost it. And it's a lot of hard work. But what allows one to keep working at that is some kind of higher thing than my own personal desires right now. So for us, it's the aspiration to Nibbana. Our teachers as inspiring role models, maybe just the image of the Buddha, the whole idea of enlightenment, all these different things help one to endure the seemingly unendurable sometimes. And this is then using this life in a different way than just personal gratification. That can also be, it can be monasticism, it can be family life, it can be vocation. And this is traditional, that vocation was like a God-given work, where one works for God, was the kind of way it was talked about, rather than for the big paycheck. And many of these things are lost in modern society. But to use life as a spiritual vehicle rather than an attempt for self-gratification, this is the challenge. So you all, like I sort of, we monastics, we stay here. So life doesn't really change that radically for us. A little bit, it gets a bit busier, of course. This just doesn't change a lot. So we have more responsibility and so on. Basically, we live in this kind of environment, so we're very fortunate. For you, again, it might be quite a culture shock. I can imagine going from this kind of a place into London, and maybe you're really keen for some culture shock. Oh gosh, I need some shock. And that's fine. But one thing, like you have a kind of, one has on a retreat, one accumulates a certain amount of goodness, virtue, right? And so. On one hand, you don't want to be selfish with it. You don't want to kind of become a turtle. You crawl back to London and say, "Don't touch me." Don't touch my peace. And yet also, you don't want to squander it. You don't want to just go out in there and have a rave up and then be back in the pits a week later. So in some sense, one wants to return to the world with gift-bestowing heart. So the attitude there is like, how can I be a benefit to all sentient beings? And that's very important, because the refinement of a retreat can be very, very nourishing and very lovely. And then complexity can seem very challenging, and then one can get attached to tranquility and refinement, and then that which is complex, you begin to resent that. So if you go home and you resent your family, then they're going to come after me. So, what have you done to these people? That's attachment to refinement, right? So the sense of just the attitude, what is the attitude now we bring back to the world? Is it kind of, leave me alone, I'm meditating? Or is it one that, how can I serve and how can I benefit? And that's a very, very important attitude. But also, like we have cultivated very wholesome things, patience, determination, some samadhi, which are kind of unseen. You might not even realize that. And then to kind of sustain the practice some way, because you've got a bit of a momentum to kind of sustain it. So to try to create a good discipline in your lives, some sense of silence, non-doing, because even sometimes meditation becomes working. Oh yeah, I've got to put meditation in my file of facts now. But to actually just create space of non-doing, is so important. Just a space to just to be and let things bubble up into consciousness, if possible. To make that a high priority, I think, is very important, because it doesn't seem productive, you know. And you know how we are. We want to fill space all the time. We want to fill it up, and we can fill it up with good works, and very wholesome things. But then the quality of our minds becomes dulled or restless until the next retreat. So to try to sustain that the quality of samadhi that one has by some kind of practices, some kind of space, very, very important. Because then, of course, the ongoing practice of contemplation is much more rewarding. You know, if you can sustain some samadhi and clarity, then in work situations, as you're getting upset or family life becomes worry, or whatever it is, you can see the arising of those. You have the contrast of space and form, of calmness and agitation. You can see them, you can work with them and learn not to get caught up by them. But if you lose the samadhi in space, as we all know, even in monasteries, one just kind of deepens one's karma. One becomes very, very reactive and gets very messy. And so realize that this is a very important part, healthy part of the spiritual life, stopping, emptying out. And then to try to have that attitude that the difficulties of one's life are one's teachers. Keep seeing it that way, so that as you go into the difficulties, try to bring up that mindset, okay, I'm going to try to be aware of how I get overwhelmed, rather than the kind of mind which says, oh gosh, a kind of dreading, anticipating mind, oh, I'll fall apart, this will never work. Try to bring up a more wholesome attitude, okay, and to try to investigate, how does this affect me, how do I get overwhelmed, or whatever it is. And then the more you do that, then that faculty of contemplation becomes like it becomes this stronger and stronger dimension, doesn't it? So that more and more you're able to contemplate in complexity when you're talking with people, and when you've got stressful situations, that the strength of sati is there to help you make appropriate, act appropriately. And then finally, just to see this as a lifetime practice, and you know, it doesn't have to be called Buddhism, and you don't have to come to Amaravati, but just the fact that we're involved in gam, we have karma, and that delusion is very deluding. And we get overwhelmed, and to abandon the unskillful and cultivate the skillful takes a long time, and yet it's always the intersection of the timeless with time. It's the curious thing about it. So it's never a becoming practice. It's always a nurturing practice, an awakening practice, and yet within it there's a kind of determination, I'll just keep doing this. And it's a funny thing about time. It's always a timeless practice, and yet one has that sense of, this will take a long time. A paradox there. So it's not a sense of me doing the practice now to become enlightened later. It's a sense of constantly bringing the mind to enlightenment and making that the practice. You're constantly awakening to the way things are, that's enlightenment. And you just do that and do that and do that. And then the power of delusion does not overwhelm, less and less. Okay, I'll leave that for reflection tonight.